evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another edition of the Heretics Hour with me, your host, Carolyn Yeager. I'm very glad that you're here with me tonight, and I'm glad to be here tonight. I'm feeling very well. It's been a cozy day with a cold front coming in, which was supposed to bring rain, but it didn't bring any rain. It just brought cold, and so I've been inside, mostly snuggled in my big warm robe, working on today's program, and feeling quite happy and content. It's December 1st today, 2014. So we're in the last month of this year. Soon it will be 2015. Just think, opening up my email account for the program, I saw that I had another donation, this one from regular contributor Dimitar, who I thank very much. And, you know, I'm so fond of Dimitar. He's one great guy. And I hope that I will be getting more attention from Santa this December, as in previous Decembers, as I do have quite a few things that need to be done for my website. And I hope that we all have a great Christmas season. I do love Christmas, but I prefer mostly these days to observe it rather than to participate too much. It makes it easier on me. And I like to take things easy. I just like to do my work mostly, and that's what satisfies me. So tonight I have really two programs in one. It came to my attention just two or three days ago that November 30th was the 75th anniversary of the Finnish Soviet War of 1939-40, known as the Winter War. Well, that was yesterday. Now, yesterday was the day that the Soviet Union, without provocation, but it wasn't a surprise, actually, but marched across the border into Finland and started a lot of war activity. So I wanted to learn more about that, because I've been interested in Finland in the last year. And I thought I should cover it tonight to bring more attention to it, if that would actually happen for my covering it. Then I also, though, I received an email earlier last week bringing up three questions about Adolf Hitler, one of which referred to Stepan Bandera, and he was questioning why the Hitler regime arrested Bandera and put him into a concentration camp, which seemed to the writer something that would help the Jews. I thought I could answer that one quicker than the other two, which I'm also interested in, but so I'm doing them both tonight. I mean, I'm doing the Winter War and the Bandera subject tonight, as though I've got two programs I'm going to try to fit in here. I want you to recall that I covered much about Bandera in my Heretics Hour program about Ukraine, which is actually the last one I did on November 17th. So this one will be more direct tonight, dealing with the subject more directly, I think, and I hope to really get it through to people what the relationship was and why. So I start with the Winter War. It began with the Soviet invasion of Finland on 30th November 1939, 3 months after the outbreak of World War II. And it ended with the Moscow Peace Treaty on 13th March 1940. So it lasted just 3.5 months, although it was a brutal war. The Soviet Union sought principally to claim parts of Finnish territory, demanding, amongst other concessions, that Finland cede substantial border territories in exchange for land elsewhere. So they, you know, give us this border territory we want, the Soviet Union said, and you can have some other land in exchange for it that is ours. That was probably some of that stuff way up north that nobody wants. But in any case, the Soviets claimed that they needed to have this for security reasons, primarily for the protection of Leningrad, their new capital, which was only 30 kilometers, which is 19 miles, from the Finnish border. as though being so close to the Finnish border, they weren't able to properly protect their city of Leningrad. And Finland simply refused. The Soviet Union then intended to conquer the entire country and establish a puppet government. Soviet Union had 3 times as many soldiers, 30 times as the number of aircraft, 100 times the tanks. However, Stalin's Great Purge of 1937 executed and imprisoned 30,000 officers, including most of the highest ranking ones. So this and the Finnish high morale caused the Finns to be able to hold off the Soviets for longer than the Soviets expected they could do, they would be able to do. But eventually, the Soviet Union offensive overcame the Finnish defenses, and Finland agreed to cede these particular small territories on the border, and the Soviet Union accepted, and a peace treaty was signed in March of 1940. Finland ceded 11% of its land. In some places it says 10%. It doesn't even seem like that much when I look at it, but anyway, that's what it's said to be. And 30% of its economy. So these must have been areas that were highly productive. However, it still seemed as a defeat for the Soviets and something of a victory for the Finns, because they retained their sovereignty. They only had to give up a little bit, and they were not overrun, and they were not taken over, which is really what the Soviet Union did to Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania, and a few other places. So France and Britain had been volunteering to send troops to Finland if they could travel through Scandinavia, where Sweden's iron ore deposits were. One of the Franco-British goals was to take control of northern Sweden's iron ore operation and cut deliveries to Germany. This was known to Germany. Germany was concerned about that and insisted to the Swedes that they not allow Britain to come through their countries, particularly up north there, or in the area where the iron ore was, which is where they were going to go through. And, you know, where they would then take over, and they said, Germany said they would attack Sweden if they did that. Germany was, of course, because of the Ribbentrop-Molotov Pact, having to remain neutral in this and not say anything. I'll talk about that in just a minute. The major factor, they never were allowed to do it. Sweden never did give that permission for that. And Finland was, I was hoping that the British would be able to come through, and some French too, and aid them. But so there was some disagreement there in the Scandinavian countries. There was help given by Swedes and Norwegians and some others, you know, who volunteers who came to help Finland, but it wasn't anything that would change the balance of the fighting, really. And this thing with the British volunteers never came through, but that was, they were going to do that in order to get into Sweden, really. And that was a major factor in Germany's operation. Now, I have a hard time pronouncing this word, Weserübung, W-E-S-E-R with an umlaut, U with an umlaut, B-U-N-G, that famous operation that took place in Norway. It was an invasion of Denmark and Norway by the Germans in order to prevent the British from getting over to Sweden and interfering with that iron ore contract of deliveries that Germany had with Sweden. And they absolutely depended on that and needed it and were very protective of it. So this, and you know, another thing about this Operation Weserübung was that it was put off and put forward several times because high-level German officers or because of high-level German leaking of the date of the operation to the Allies. And Hitler knew about that, found out about it, and would canceled it because the date for the operation had been the attack on Norway had been leaked by someone. It turned out to be these traitors in the German higher command who were already doing this, already leaking information to the Allies because they didn't want a war to take place. They thought they didn't want Germany to go to war or with the English and French. Let's see, this was in 1940. So after the Polish invasion and the British French had declared war on Germany, well, these people were trying to. There was an element that wanted to end it, and they thought that if they gave information to the enemy and weakened the German position, that it would stop the war right where it was or something like that. So, but eventually it did take place. And the interesting thing was that a lot of, some of those who were given that information didn't believe it. They thought it was a false information. So anyway, that operation was carried out and it was highly successful for the Germans, and that whole Norwegian operation was very, very important and very successful for the Germans in the end. And then, to go on to the Ribbentrop-Molotov Pact, which you should be familiar with, that was signed between Germany with the Soviet Union in order to allow Germany to fight on its west, since war had been declared on it. Germany did not declare war, just to remind you of that, on Britain or France or anyone except its war with Poland. But they declared war on Germany, and it was kind of a quiet for a while, called the phony war, but it started heating up, and Hitler had made plans, and he had to start executing his plans. And there was some bombing and so on before that. So he was happy to sign this pact with the Soviet Union because Britain was trying to sign its own pact with the Soviet Union at that time, ahead of that. But the Soviet Union decided to sign the pact with Germany. They thought that was in their best interest. And even though it wasn't a perfect situation, it was what Hitler needed at the time, and therefore, he was really justified in doing it. There was this secret protocol that was attached to it, which supposedly wasn't known to the world until 1945, that when it was discovered. But it set aside spheres of interest between Germany and the Soviet Union. It was a bad bargain, but Hitler, I think, had no choice, because he had to satisfy these voracious demands of the Russians in order to get this agreement that he needed. And they kept adding to it. So even though there was a secret protocol signed, then a little bit later there was a revision to it. And it got even more in the interests of the Soviet Union. So what happened here was that Germany fights a war with Poland, and the Soviet Union takes the eastern half of it. This is after the pact was signed, you know. And then the Soviet Union forces treaties on the Baltic states, Estonia, Lithuania, and Latvia. And it wants to force the same kind of a thing on Finland, allowing it to take a lot of control of the capitals and so on. And Finland refuses. Finland begins mobilizing, but it hadn't deployed. Then the Soviet Union has already been mobilizing near the Finnish border, but deployment didn't start until October, for when they decided that they would have a November invasion, because Finland wasn't cooperating. Well, the little Baltic states knew that would happen, so they felt they had no choice but to give in to the Soviet Union. Now, this second protocol, this protocol, it accorded, the secret protocol accorded the area of Romania, Poland, and Lithuania, at least the part that Germany already controlled, not the eastern part, but their part of Poland, Romania, and Lithuania into the German sphere, and Germany was absolutely felt they needed to control Romania, or not to have the access to Romania because the oil fields there. The sphere of interest for the Soviet Union was Latvia, Estonia, and Finland. And Lithuania was in the German sphere because it was close to East Prussia and so on. And the others were what Russia demanded. And then the Poland was going to be partitioned in the event of its political rearrangement. Then there came to be this second secret protocol. You see that, and I know from reading some of these things that continued on until the German invasion of the Soviet Union, that the Russians kept coming over and saying, demanding more things from Germany, more and more. Germany finally, Hitler realized that this was not going to stop, and he had no choice but to attack the Soviet Union, or they were just going to keep pushing and pushing him until he couldn't. He lost all of his all the resources that he needed. So in this second, but he did go along with this second secret protocol, or what would have been maybe an addition to the other one. It agreed, this was in September 1939 still, not, you know, very close to the original one. He reassigned the majority, or after the Polish invasion, the majority of Lithuania was reassigned to the USSR. And I don't know why that was allowed to happen, but that's what it says. So according to this secret protocol, Lithuania would be granted the city of Vilnius, its historical capital, which had been under Polish control during the interwar period. But other things would be under the Soviet Union would be allowed to have influence there, and the Germans would allow it. So another cause of the treaty was that Germany would not interfere with the Soviet Union's actions toward Bessarabia. Another clause, I mean. So not only did they give way more on Lithuania, they gave way more on Bessarabia, which was a part of Romania at that time. So the Soviet Union pushed and got that. As a result, Bessarabia was joined to the Moldovan ASSR and became the Moldovan SSR under control of Moscow. So this was the way that Stalin just kept pushing Hitler to take more and more, and Hitler at that time didn't want to get into a confrontation with the Soviet Union because he was involved in the war in the West. So he allowed some things to happen, which was too bad, but finally he had to, it just kept happening, you know. They kept doing the same thing, and finally he had to do something about it. But by then he had secured Western Europe. So that's the background of that as it comes to these Baltic countries and Finland. Now let me see where I am here. If I left anything out. Okay. So I was going through some items here. We had the Ribbentrop-Molotov Pact and the secret protocol and why that took place. And then Germany fights the war with Poland, and the Soviet Union just walks in and takes the eastern half, and they're allowed to do that. And then the Soviet Union enforces the treaties on the Baltic states. Okay, now, all right, I'm sorry, I'm repeating myself here. So the Soviets' deployment started in October by the Russians for invasion in November. Now, I looked at November timeline for World War II, and I found some interesting things. Between the 1st and the 13th of November, on the 1st, Parts of Poland, including the Danzig Corridor, are annexed by Germany, and the Soviet Union annexes the eastern part of occupied Poland, yes. It annexes this part of Poland to Ukraine and Belarus. And on the 3rd, Finland and Soviet Union again negotiate new borders. The Finns mistrust Stalin's aims and refuse to give up territory, breaking their defensive line, which would break their defensive line, you know. So they're holding off. The U.S. Neutrality Act is passed on the 4th of November, which means that the French and British may buy arms, but on a strictly cash basis. Some neutrality, you see. They're allowing one side of this dispute, the French and British, to buy arms from them, but say that, well, it has to be cash, so that makes it all right. But American isolationists find this an outrage and complain about it. On the 4th, here's what bothered me. A German physicist working at Siemens AG, a German company, sends an anonymous letter to the British Embassy in Oslo, Norway, offering England a report on present and future German weapons technologies. This is the kind of thing Germans were doing. This is the kind of thing Hitler had to deal with. These Germans who wanted to help the enemy because they were afraid, they didn't want war, they thought, they didn't trust Hitler too. They are anti-Hitler types and so on. Then on the 8th of November, Hitler escapes the bomb blast in the Munich Beer Hall, where he was speaking on the anniversary of the Beer Hall Putsch of 1923. And it says something odd here. It says British bombers coincidentally bomb Munich. Well, I looked and looked to find something about British bombers bombing Munich at that time in supposedly November 8, 1939. I didn't find anything, so I thought I'd ask tonight if anybody listening knows anything about this or has heard about it or anything, because I think it has to be a mistake. I don't think there are any British bombs falling on Munich in 1939, but if so, I'd like to hear about it, if you can tell me anything you know about it. Then on the November 13th, negotiations between Finland and Soviet Union break down. Finns doubt that Germans and Russians have agreed to include Finland in the Soviet sphere of influence. The Finns are distrustful of the idea that the Germans signed something that would include Finland in the Soviet sphere of influence. But it happened to be true, unfortunately. And anyway, then I was telling you about that secret protocol. So that is the lead up. And on November 30th, 1939, Stalin ordered his forces to begin to attack Finland. On that date, Soviet planes dropped 600 bombs on Helsinki, killing 91 Finns. So they came on very strong with their bombers over Helsinki. And this unprovoked Soviet attack so angered the Finns that thousands of them immediately took up arms and went to the front, often without uniforms because none were available. They were vastly outnumbered in personnel and arms, but they were inspired by Marshal Mannerheim, who said, "We are fighting for our home, faith, and fatherland." And that's when you fight the hardest, if you really are fighting for your home and your fatherland, and I suppose for your faith. So on December 1st, the Soviet Union had crossed the line and formed a puppet government called the Finnish Democratic Republic, which is headed by O.W. Kuzinen, who was a communist. And was a longtime communist. So he was cooperating with the Soviets, although he was a Finn. But this government, you know, didn't accomplish much. I mean, they just set it up as pretending like they had a government there. The government was also called the Teriyaki, if that's the correct pronunciation, T-E-R-I-J-O-K-I, and that's the English spelling. The Teriyaki government, after the village of Teriyaki, which was the first settlement captured by the advancing Soviet army. After the war, the puppet government was disbanded, but from the outset of the war, working class Finns stood behind the legal government in Helsinki. Nobody recognized that silly karaoke government. Finnish national unity against the Soviet invasion was later called the Spirit of the Winter War. So the Finnish strategy was dictated by geography. The frontier with the Soviet Union was more than 1,000 kilometers, 620 miles long, but was mostly impassable except along a handful of unpaved roads. In pre-war calculations, the Finnish General Staff, which had established its wartime headquarters at Mikkeli, M-I-K-K-E-L-I, estimated 7 Soviet divisions on the isthmus and no more than 5 along the whole border north of Lake Ladoga. Boy, I just never realized how far north Lake Ladoga is. It's north of Leningrad. In that case, the manpower ratio would favor the attacker by 3-1. The true ratio was much higher, for example. What we're saying here is that it's much more than the Finns had anticipated. There was 12 Soviet divisions deployed to the north of Lake Ladoga rather than what they had estimated would be only 5 north of Lake Ladoga. But he started out with 12, and then all the divisions in other places too. An even greater problem than lack of soldiers for the Finns was the lack of materiel. Foreign shipments of anti-tank weapons and aircraft were arriving in small quantities. The ammunition situation was alarming, as stockpiles had cartridges, shells, and fuel only to last 19 to 60 days. The ammunition situation was alleviated somewhat because many Finns were armed with Mosin Nagant rifles dating from the Finnish Civil War, updated infantry weapons capable of chambering the same type of cartridges used by the Soviet forces. So I don't know about this Mosin Nagant, but I guess it might be a Russian-made rifle that the Russians were using too, or at least the ammunition fit. So some Finnish soldiers maintained their ammunition supply by looting the bodies of dead Soviet soldiers. The ammunition shortage meant the Finns could seldom afford counter battery or saturation fire. Finnish tank forces were operationally non-existent. That is, they really didn't have any tanks. And their air force was really pathetic, you know. I mean, you wouldn't even call it a real air force, but they had some planes. And they had an air force, you know. But, you know, they were just totally outgunned there in every department, except for the geography. And speaking of here of the weather conditions, the major Soviet operations during the winter, the winter of 1939 to 1940 was exceptionally cold. Not as cold as that one 41-42, but exceptionally cold still. One location on the Karelian Isthmus experienced a record low temperature of minus 43 degrees centigrade. And this is not right. It says here, which is minus 45 degrees Fahrenheit. That's not right. There's some mistake here. But if that would be much lower Fahrenheit if it was minus 43 centigrade. So on January 16th, 1940, that's the date that low temperature was recorded, on January 16th, 1940. At the beginning of the war, only those Finnish soldiers who were in active service had uniforms and weapons. So all those volunteers that, you know, went off to the front to fight in their high spirits and dedication and so on, they had to make do with their own clothing, which for many soldiers was their normal winter clothing with some semblance of an insignia added, that they added, I guess, to show that they're part of the Finnish army or But the Finnish soldiers were skilled in cross-country skiing, which the Soviets were not. The cold, the snow, the forest, and the long hours of darkness were all factors that the Finns could use to their advantage. The Finns dressed in layers, and the ski troopers wore a lightweight white snow cape. This snow camouflage made the ski troopers almost invisible as the Finns executed guerrilla attacks against Soviet columns. At the beginning of the war, Soviet tanks were painted in standard olive drab, and men dressed in regular khaki uniforms, kind of an olive drab color too, green. Not until late January 1940 did the Soviets paint their equipment white and issue snowsuits to their infantry. So they were easy to spot for the first 2 months. We had December and January. Then there's February and only half of March. Anyway, the first month of this seemed like an eternity. Well, in just reading about it, you know, what a difficult time fighting this war. But most Soviet soldiers had proper winter clothes, but this was not the case with every unit. In a particular battle of Suomussalmi, that was a very important one and went for a long time too, many Soviet soldiers died of frostbite. Furthermore, the Soviet troops lacked skill in skiing, so soldiers were restricted to movement by road and were forced to move in long columns. Well, they didn't have many roads in Finland, so that didn't help them either. Furthermore, the Red Army lacked proper winter tents, and men had to sleep in improvised shelters in many cases. And some Soviet units had frostbite casualties as high as 10%, even before crossing the Finnish border. The cold weather did confer why they decided to do this on November 30th. I don't know, but they thought, despite the cold, they would have this thing finished up in 1 month. That's what the Soviets thought, because they had such an advantage in numbers and in material. In any case, the cold weather conferred one advantage to the Soviets. Their tanks were able to move more easily over the frozen terrain and bodies of water, iced over water, rather than being immobilized in swamps and mud, which was going to happen when spring came, and they knew that. So they wanted to get it over with. Before the Winter War, no army had fought in such freezing conditions. In Soviet field hospitals, operations were done and limbs were amputated in 20 below centigrade temperatures, which here they say corresponds to 4 below Fahrenheit. While just past the canvas tent wall, the temperature was minus 30% centigrade. Okay, so I get mixed up. My usual mix-up, Fahrenheit are higher numbers than the centigrade, that's right. So 20 degrees centigrade is 4 degrees Fahrenheit. But that other one was still wrong up above. Can you imagine? I can't. I just think, oh my, how do these medical personnel operate in that kind of cold and do all that they're doing? I don't know. It just seems, I can't stand cold like that. Well, I'm going to say up ahead what I would do if I was in that situation. So the injured Finnish soldiers could expect, but the injured Finnish soldiers could expect a heated operating room, and supposedly this improved their fighting abilities while hampering the Soviet soldiers. Well, it certainly would hamper the Soviet soldiers if I get injured. I'm going to have to go and be in my injured state in a frozen tent and continue to freeze. You would not want to take any chances, would you? You'd want to protect yourself so you wouldn't get injured. But as we know, they were forced to do a lot of frontal attacks, which decimated their ranks because they had they would be shot if they didn't go out there like they were ordered to. So now we're going to look at Finnish tactics a little bit more. And the Finns used guerrilla tactics. They had to. The Red Army was superior in numbers and material, but the Finns used the advantages of speed, tactics, and economy of force, particularly on the Ladoga-Karelia front and during the Battle of Raate Road. That was quite a battle, R-A-A-T-E. The Finns isolated smaller portions of numerically superior Soviet forces. And with the Soviet forces divided into smaller pieces, the Finns could deal with them individually and attack from all sides. So rather than try to attack a large number of, thousands, they managed to somehow isolate them. And then they could go after them, kind of the way you might think wild animals isolate one from the herd, and then they all go after that one and attack him, and they do that over and over again. So for many of the encircled Soviet troops in a pocket, and they always seem to want to point out that in Finnish, that term is moti, M-O-T-T-I, moti, which means a bundle of wood, but that's what they use for to talk about a military pocket. Just staying alive was an ordeal comparable to combat. The men were freezing. We're talking about the Soviets now. They were freezing and starving when they got caught in one of these pockets called when they're separated off by themselves and surrounded. And they endured poor sanitary conditions. Historian William R. Trotter describes these conditions thus. The Soviet soldier had no choice. If he refused to fight, he would be shot. If he tried to sneak through the forest, he would freeze to death. And surrender was no option for him. Soviet propaganda had told him how the Finns would torture prisoners to death. Well, they wouldn't have, but that's maybe they believed it. Well, if I was in this situation, freezing and starving, I would use my gun to shoot myself through the head. That's what I would do. I would put an end to my suffering. But I suppose if you get cold enough and starving enough, you might go into kind of a trance type affair. You might just not feel it all that much. You might not realize what's happening to you. You might not realize your fingers and toes are being frostbitten and eaten away. You might just be enduring and enduring with the rest of them. So maybe if you don't really know, but if you're fully aware of what's going on, I think that would be the best solution for a Russian, for a Soviet soldier. Put an end to it himself, because there's no way out of this. The terrain on the Karelian Isthmus did not allow the exercise of guerrilla tactics, so the Finns were forced to resort to the more conventional Mannerheim line, with its flanks protected by large bodies of water. Soviet propaganda claimed that it was as strong or even stronger than the Maginot Line. See, they lied about that. Finnish historians, for their part, have belittled the line's strength, insisting that it was mostly conventional trenches and log-covered dugouts. But the Soviets by now were trying to explain to their own public and to the world also why they weren't doing better, why they were being held back by the Finns. So they came up with the story that this Mannerheim line was as strong or even stronger than the Maginot Line in Europe, which it wasn't. The Finns had built 221 strong points along the Karelian Isthmus, mostly in the early 1920s. Many were extended in the late 1930s. Despite these defensive preparations, even the most fortified section of the Mannerheim Line had only one reinforced concrete bunker per kilometer. Overall, the line was weaker than similar lines in mainland Europe. According to the Finns, the real strength of the line were the stubborn defenders with a lot of sisu. Sisu is a Finnish idiom, roughly translated as guts and fighting spirit. The Soviet advance was stopped at the Mannerheim line, though. The Red Army troops suffered from poor morale and a shortage of supplies, eventually refusing to participate in more suicidal frontal attacks. So they, I guess if enough of them refused, they weren't going to shoot them all. I don't know. So they weren't going to do it anymore. In spite of the cold and hunger, the Soviet troops did not surrender easily, but fought bravely, often entrenching their tanks to be used as pillboxes and building timber dugouts. They were doing their best. The Soviet advance slowed as Finnish resistance grew, but the Finns, having suffered 25,000 combat dead in the course of 105 days fighting, finally had to sue for peace, even though they had inflicted 126,000 dead on the invaders. And they had to yield a tenth of their territory to Moscow. In northern Karelia, Soviet forces were outmaneuvered at Ilomantsi and Liksa, L-I-E-K-S-A. The Finns there used effective guerrilla tactics, taking special advantage of superior skiing skills and snow-white layered clothing, and executing many surprise ambushes and raids by their skiers. By the end of December, the Soviets decided to retreat and transfer resources to more critical fronts. So they had to give up in that part of the country. Now here's the Suomussalmi Rata Road victory. I have no idea how to pronounce these. The Rata Road is R-A-A-T-E, and the other one is spelled S-U-O-M-U-S-S-A-I-M-I. And the Rata Road is in the Suomussalmi area there. The Battle of Rata Road, which occurred during the month-long battle of Suomussalmi, resulted in one of the largest losses in the Winter War. The Soviet 44th and parts of the 163rd Rifle Divisions, comprising about 14,000 troops, were almost completely destroyed by a Finnish ambush as they marched along the forest road. Well, this makes me think of Teutoburg, the way they describe that. A small unit blocked the Soviet advance, while Finnish Colonel Halmar Silvasuo, that's Finnish, Swedish or something, and his 9th Division cut off the retreat route, split the enemy force into smaller fragments, and then proceeded to destroy the remnants in detail as they retreated. The Soviets suffered 7,000 to 9,000 casualties, while the Finnish units lost only 400 men. Think about that. In addition, the Finnish troops captured dozens of tanks, artillery pieces, anti-tank guns, hundreds of trucks, almost 2,000 horses, thousands of rifles, and much-needed ammunition and medical supplies. What a fantastic victory. But even so, they couldn't repeat that everywhere all the time. So the Finns gained similar successes in northern Lapland. The Soviets changed tactics then and changed their strategy and broke through the Mannerheim line in February. They increased their troops from 10 divisions to 25 to 26 divisions and 6 or 7 tank brigades, and several independent tank platoons totaling 600,000 men. This is what it took them to break through in Finland. The Soviets began increasing bombardments. They had an air force, wearing down the defenders and softening their fortifications. During daylight hours, the Finns took shelter inside their fortifications. From the bombardments and repaired damage, no, sorry, I stopped there. During the daylight hours, the Finns took shelter inside their fortifications from the bombardments, and they repaired damage during the night. So they came out at night to do what they needed to do. The situation led quickly to war exhaustion among the Finns, who lost over 3,000 men in trench warfare. Although the Soviets could do better when it came to trench warfare, because they had all those planes and ammunition. Although the Soviets refined their tactics and morale improved, the generals were still willing to accept massive losses in order to reach their objectives. Attacks were screened by smoke, heavy artillery, and armor support, but the infantry charged in the open and in dense formations. That's a favorite Soviet war procedure or war tactic. That they're always doing that, and it shows that they don't value their men, or they have so many. They always have a superiority of numbers, so they just throw them at the enemy, and I suppose they have success with that. That's why they keep doing it. They wouldn't keep doing it if they didn't, but it's a high cost of human life, and it shows that they don't care about their human life the way other countries do. They have so many, and they're mixed race too. They're not a tightly knit nation, so that's why that happens. I think it's pretty horrible to do that. The Finns could not easily eliminate tanks if infantry troops protected them. So after 10 days of round-the-clock artillery barrages by the Soviets, the Soviets achieved a breakthrough on the western Karelian Isthmus in the Second Battle of Suma. By mid-February, it became clear that the Finnish forces were rapidly approaching exhaustion. For the Soviets, casualties were high. The situation was a source of political embarrassment to the Soviet regime, and there was a risk of Franco-British intervention on the side of the Finns. Furthermore, with the spring thaw approaching, the Soviet forces risked becoming bogged down in the forests. The Finnish foreign minister, Väinö Tanner, arrived in Stockholm on 12 February and negotiated the peace terms with the Soviets through the Swedes. On 29 February, the Finnish government accepted the Soviet terms in principle and was willing to enter into negotiations. The Finnish government, noting that the hoped-for Franco-British military expedition would not arrive in time, as Norway and Sweden had not given the Allies right of passage, had little choice but to accept the Soviet terms. The formal peace treaty was signed in Moscow on 12 March. So there we go. We get to the middle of March, the end of the war. Now, as to the outcome, Moscow gained far less than they expected from the loss of 126,000 men and a great deal of prestige that they lost. Moreover, the way in which Finland and the Soviet Union treated their combat losses spoke volumes about the differences between the two countries, differences which are in evidence in Ukraine and Russia now. When the war began, Mannerheim ordered that each soldier killed was to be buried with military honors in specially designated cemeteries. However, in the Soviet Union, Andrei Zhadanov, head of the Leningrad CPSU Obkom, that's the Communist Party of the Soviet Union, Communist Party head, categorically forbid telling relatives of dead soldiers about the destruction of their near ones, and to take other steps to hide such losses as well. Boy, that's what's going on here. Like Ukraine, the Finns faced an overwhelming adversary, a horde which wanted to suppress its opponents by its size. David went into the ring against Goliath, and he won. Well, he won, sort of. And, of course, the Finns were frightened, but they were not intimidated, and they fought like lions. They understood something that Ukrainians should as well, just trying to relate this to what's going on today in Ukraine. In war, the main thing is not the quantity, but motivation and intelligence. Well, Finns have some of the highest IQ in Europe, but the Ukrainians don't. So I understand, I think that's true. You know, motivation and intelligence can outperform large numbers, but you have to have it. I don't know if the Ukrainians have the motivation and intelligence that the Finns had, but I still think that they have a lot of desire, and they show a lot of, I think they've shown that they have a lot of unity amongst them. They have a lot of love for their independence and for being Ukrainian, something that's been, they've been prevented from enjoying for most of their existence, I think. So I'll end here with a famous quote from the Battle of Kola, which is from Major General Haglund's question. Major General Haglund asked, "Will Kola hold of the hero of Kola?" And to which Lieutenant Arne Juutilainen, whatever it is, that man whose picture was on the post for this show, replied, "Kola will hold unless the orders are to run away." That's a simple question and reply have entered the Finnish lexicon as an expression of perseverance and resolve in the face of impending difficulty or crisis. Well, that's become a permanent, what you call, lexicon in Finnish, that something will hold unless the orders are to run away. You know, this brings to mind, as soon as I read that, I thought of the police officer, Darren Wilson, who has been released from his police force duties without any severance pay or anything, who's still being attacked by the globe, by the media, and just about every news source, and of course all the blacks and so on. But you know what he said in his interview, when that ABC, that little ABC news guy, can't think of his name, he's been there forever, was interviewing him, and he said to Wilson, "Well, did it ever occur to you to just drive away or walk away when this black guy who was suspected of this crime that had just been committed, that he was that's why he was trying to talk to him. But when this black guy was attacking him, about twice as big as Wilson was, and Wilson said to this ABC News guy, 'You mean run away? Like, what are you talking about?' He said, 'Police don't run away. You know, a policeman doesn't run away from the scene and leave the suspect there to do whatever he wants to do.'" Now, this is the kind of craziness that we're into, that the Finns here understood better than most people, and still do understand better than most people today, than a lot of people, what you need to do to stand up. Because if you start running away, well, then there's no end to it. But can you believe that? I thought that was the most defining moment of that interview. The other thing I'd like to emphasize a little bit is the what happens in the Soviet Union and it happening in Russia today, where they want to hide their soldiers' deaths because they don't want to. I think that's about as bad as it gets. You know, they don't want the public to realize what's going on, or they don't want to have protests. They don't want the families to get upset, and so they don't even tell them. They want to cover up the number of casualties that they're experiencing, rather than giving them the honor that's due them, and not even send them. Sometimes they do send the bodies back to the family, but sometimes they haven't even done that, and the family's looking for them. So that's a huge difference. And as I said, it's still going on today with the war in Ukraine. by the Russian government and the Putin government. Something to think about. I'm going to play a little bit of break music here. Take a little break. I think I will. I guess I'll play this Otto Stenzel. It's just 2 minutes and 53 seconds, just about 3 minutes. So it's just some swing music, which should lift up the mood a little bit here. So we'll be right. I'll be back in 3 minutes, ladies and gentlemen.
Weiter nicht als nur Musik, Musik, Musik. Doch eine ganze Kleinigkeit, die brauch ich noch dazu. Und diese große Kleinigkeit bist du, nur du, nur du, 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 du. Ich brauche keine Millionen, mir fehlt kein Pfennig zum Glück. Ich brauch nur deine Liebe und Musik, Musik, Musik.
Ladies and gentlemen, I don't think that was the right song for me to play during this break, but I wish I would have picked one that was a little more solemn. But anyway, that's what I did, so there we go. Too bad, too late now. This is Carolyn Yeager coming back for the second hour of the Heretics Hour on December 1st, 2014. And the subject is moving to Stepan Bandera and many things surrounding him, and it came up because of someone who's commented, and then we emailed a little bit back and forth, and he's interested in the Russian situation, and he is interested in Joel Skousen's ideas, which he wanted me to look into, and then he said, after commenting on that a little bit, he said, as for Hitler, he admits that the Skousen seems to not have a good opinion of Hitler. And he says, as for Hitler, I'll be honest with you, I'm in two minds. While there is much good to be said about Hitler's National Socialist policies, which are completely natural counter to the communist aggression of the time, but some in Israel, Christian Identity, have said, this is him, telling me this, some in Israel Christian Identity have said that Hitler's policies were as close to God's laws written in the Bible that we've ever had throughout history, which is certainly reason enough for Jewry to denounce Hitler's National Socialism in the strongest possible terms. However, he says, there are two big question marks in my mind in the context of the agendas of the powerful Jewish banking families in the time, or at the time, I suppose he means. Hitler's astronomical rise to power in such a short time, at a time when many people believed the Jews wanted another world war. That's one. The other one was how Germany lost the war from a strong position in such a way that it seemed to serve the bankers' interests. Well, you know, just these two can actually be answered very easily, but perhaps it wouldn't satisfy people. But in the first place, Hitler's rise to power was not astronomical. It wasn't. It was very understandable, and he worked very hard at it from 1919 until 1933. So it was a lot of work, and a lot of energy and activity went about. But we also had the situation in Germany at that time, which was quite, and the terrible economic conditions, the problem of the demands of the Versailles Treaty and all of that, which certainly made it understandable that people were looking for someone who would deal with these things. So it wasn't a sudden astronomical rise that can't be explained except that the Jews wanted it. Now, the other one, that Hitler lost the war from a strong position. What strong position? Hitler was never in a strong position. He was in a strong position at home, finally, amongst the Germans. He was never in a strong position in the world, but he did what he had to do, and he was bringing Germany. He was He wanted Germany to stand up for its interests, for its rights, and to be as strong as any other nation. He was concerned about being recognized in the community of nations. That's it. But there was no, that he was never in a strong position that he somehow. Lost the war that he should have won. It's a wonder they did as well as they did. Those two things. But then he goes on to say, did they not jail the Ukrainian nationalist leader, Stephen Bandera, towards the end of the war too? Some say this served Jewry, but I don't really know the full story. Now, I'm recognizing that this person admits and doesn't know very much about it, but is saying things that he's heard or that he just thinks without really investigating on his own very much. And, you know, this usual conspiracy theory kind of stuff. But a lot of people do question Stepan Bandera and the way he, his relationship with the National Socialists, with even the German Wehrmacht, with Hitler, with the Gestapo, etc. So here's the story. In 1941, while Bandera was cooperating with the Germans, the OUN members did take part in anti-Jewish actions. They were not pro-Jewish, but we're talking about at times they did, at times they didn't. OUN is the organization for the Revolutionary Army of the Ukrainians, and of course I talked about this. I said in the beginning of the show that I did. I talked about this 2 weeks ago when I did the last time I did this program. So I'm just going on a little bit more, but I'm not going to do all this. I'm not going to explain all this background too much tonight. You have to know what it is that we're talking about: the Ukrainian Nationalist Party, the most fanatical one, the most important one, you know, the one that had was doing all the activity, that was following during the 1930s when they were being so persecuted by the Poles, by those who were because Poland had all that territory. When the Germans came in and demolished Poland, then the Bandera people were very happy, and all the revolutionaries and all the Ukrainian nationalists were very happy about that. But what happened to it? Well, what happened was, well, I'm going to explain it all here. The German police in 1941 reported that fanatic Bandera followers organized in small groups were extraordinarily active against Jews and communists. But in 1942, by 1942, I might say, the German intelligence concluded that Ukrainian nationalists were indifferent to the plight of the Jews and were willing to either kill them or help them, depending on what better served their cause. Several Jews took part in Bandera's underground movement, including one of Bandera's close associates, Richard Yari, who was also married to a Jewish woman. Another notable Jewish UPA member was Lebia Itzik Dombrovsky, who was known as Valerie. According to a report to the chief of the security police in Berlin, dated March 30, 1942, it has been clearly established that the Bandera movement provided forged passports not only for its own members, but also for Jews. The false papers were most likely supplied to, like Jewish doctors or skilled workers who could be useful for the movement, it is said, but probably, but even so, this is not in the, this was not in the interest of the Germans, nor what they wanted, nor the SS, how they wanted things to be going, the direction they wanted things to be going. So the point of this is that the Ukrainians were interested in one thing: totally sovereign, strong, nationalist Ukraine for themselves. And whoever could help them get that is who they were aligning with. And at a certain point, it was the Germans who they thought would help them get that, because the Germans came and got rid of the Poles. But then there was the Russians, the Soviets, and now the Germans' interest was in defeating the Soviets, whereas the interest of Bandera's movement change to being able to make use of this, what was going on at the time, to gain their own freedom and independence from everyone, including the Germans. And they would use anyone, including Jews, who were helpful to them. So they had preferences, but they didn't have a particular prejudice against any group saying, well, we'll never work with this group, because they would work with anyone who they thought would be advantageous to them at the time. And there's many people like this, and there's many people who think this is the way to do it. And this goes on all the time, that people switch and change and work with these people because they seem to be, you know, sharing the same interest, and they'll turn against those people and join with some other people. This goes on, but it's not about the only principle that the Ukrainian nationalists had, and that Bandera had, which he didn't admit, you know, would have admitted, was the Ukrainian nationalist movement and the freedom, the liberation of Ukrainians to have a sovereign nation of their own. So this was not, though, what Germany wanted. And Germany's interest was not to help all these groups have their own sovereign nation, but was to have them be cooperating in Germany's interest in all of this. So that is where things separated. And when Bandera was in conflict with the Germans, the Ukrainian insurgent army under his authority sheltered many Jews, and included, now, he wasn't even there at the time. He was he had been arrested, but the Ukrainian insurgent army was still under his authority, so to speak, and they were sheltering Jews, and they included Jewish fighters and medical personnel among their ranks. In the official organ of the OUNB, that's the Ukrainian insurgent army Banderas, there was two groups, the one M, the other leader and then the Bandera leader. They kind of had a split there, and people were in one or the other. The Bandera group, they gave instructions that urged, there was an official paper or something, instructions sent out to the Bandera group that said, that urged them to liquidate the manifestations of harmful foreign influence, particularly the German racist concepts and practices. So this was official. This was in writing. They know about this, and they were because they were getting help from different, even from Jews, you know, because they're getting help from Jews and accepting it and working with Jews, because the Jews were looking out for themselves too. You know, the Jews were saying, well, if I join with these people, I'll be better off and I can push for, you know, save Jews and save myself, whatever. So I'll go this way. That's the only the best choice I have right now. So this was going on, and so the Ukrainian group, a Banderas group, was saying that we don't want to have these racist concepts and practices which originate from the Germans. So by November 25th, a National Socialist document stated, November 25th, this would be 1941, the Bandera movement is preparing a revolt in the Reichskommissariat, which has as its ultimate aim the establishment of an independent Ukraine. All functionaries of the Bandera movement must be arrested at once, and after thorough interrogation, are to be liquidated. No, that was supposedly a document that was found that said that. So there was no love lost now. They were seeing one another as enemies, even though they were both enemies of the Soviets. And the Reichskommissariat is the area that was Ukraine. That was now controlled, occupied by the Germans. In January, now Bandera was arrested sometime in 1941, and he was taken to Berlin. And I think he was questioned, and he was, you know, he was just held there. But he and discussions were held and so on. But he wasn't imprisoned exactly. But in January 1942, they put him in Sachsenhausen, in the special barrack there for high-profile political prisoners. It has a name, this barrack, but it means that he was treated very well. He did not work. He wasn't treated like an ordinary prisoner, but he was contained. He was under control. He was held. He wasn't allowed to go out and do anything. So he stayed there until September 1944. And when the Germans did then release it, they talked to him for a while first, and then they worked out some plans, and they released him in hopes that he would incite the Ukrainian populace to fight against the encroaching Soviet army. And at that time, the Germans supplied his organization with arms and equipment, and also agents trained to conduct terrorist and intelligence activities behind Soviet lines. So apparently, the concern about their friendship with the Jews and so on was not important anymore, or was not actually, you know, they had cleared out the Jews. So they were now willing to use him at this late hour. It's true, it was a late hour. But I don't know. I don't think he accomplished much. And so I don't know if he ever would have accomplished much. You know, I don't see that the Ukrainian people as a whole or in general were ready to be organized or worked up by either of these Ukrainian nationalist groups, the Bandera one or the one that starts with the man's name started with the initial M. I forgot now, Nicholas or something. It's not that, but I had it there 2 weeks ago, but I've forgotten what the name is. But I don't know that they would have accomplished anything in 1941 and 1942. And they would have gone, and they were going after the Germans. They wanted to get the Germans out of there. They wanted only Ukrainians in Ukraine. They didn't want to work with the Germans to fight the Soviets. They weren't of the same mind. They weren't on the same page. They weren't trying to do the same thing. And they didn't even by then welcome the Germans. I don't know how strong they thought they were. But Bandera is known to be was totally fanatical, unable to work with others or subordinate himself at all. He was, totally Ukraine freedom and sovereignty, and that's what we're after, and we don't have time for anything else, or we're not going to go along with anything else. So he was very much that way. Now, what happened to his family? His mother died when he was only around 10 years old or younger than 10, somewhere around that age. May have had an effect on him in some way, but his father was a Catholic priest, and his mother's father was a Catholic priest too, Greek Catholic they were, and his two brothers were arrested and interned in Auschwitz, probably because they were his brothers, so they would have been arrested by the Germans if they were interned in Auschwitz. But they were killed there by Polish inmates. It wasn't the intention of Germans to kill them, I'm quite sure, but you can understand why the Poles would, because the Poles and the Ukrainians at this time were just the worst enemies you can imagine. They were just totally against one another, and they had been carrying out, that was in 1943 that they carried out all those massacres in Volhynia. But the Ukrainians had been put into Polish territory after World War I, and the Poles treated them very, very badly and wanted to destroy their Ukrainian nationality. So then when the Poles lost control there, the Ukrainians then were treating the Poles very badly and trying, who were still there and who happened to still be there, and they wanted to, territory went back to Ukraine, but they wanted to cleanse it of Poles. So the Poles and the Ukrainians were total enemies. So if this was Bandera's brothers, the Poles in the camp in Auschwitz found a way to murder these two men. I think it's sad because they were both highly educated. One had a PhD and the other was a graduate in philosophy from the Lviv University. And then his father, Stepan Bandera's father, was arrested in May 1941 for harboring an OUN member, and he was transferred to Kiev. In 8th July, he was sentenced to death and executed by the NKVD, because this is May 1941, before the Germans arrived. So while it was still under Soviet control, his father was arrested and executed. And his sisters, Oksana and Marta Maria, were also arrested by the NKVD in 1941, and they were sent to a gulag in Siberia. They weren't released until 1960, but without the right to return to Ukraine. So the one sister died there in 1982, and the other one managed to return to Ukraine in 1989, when, things, Soviet Union started falling apart. And she died in 2004. So his family was really decimated, and maybe if it wasn't for him, that wouldn't have happened to them. But it did. So, but it's mostly by the Soviet Union. It was the Soviet Union that really hates this Bandera and everything that he stands for. Another sister was sentenced to a term in a Soviet labor camp from 1946 to 1956, after the war, when the Soviets were in control again, they got his last family member and sent her to a labor camp. And she didn't return to Ukraine until 1956, after her sentence was completed. So the Germans treated Stepan Bandera better than the Russians did, but they knew that his activity there and his influence was working against them. So they arrested him and took him to Germany and with a lot of other members of his organization too, and then kept them in a concentration camp, but under special kind of conditions, and then released them at the end of the war. But at the end of after the war, Bandera went to Germany. I don't know when he went to Germany. He probably went to Germany as soon as everything was collapsing, because the Russians were going to kill him. So he lived in Germany until 1959, when he died. He was murdered again by the NKVD. He collapsed on October 15th, 1959, he collapsed in Munich after he came out of some building, and he died shortly thereafter, and a medical examination established that the cause of his death was poisoned by cyanide, and he was buried in Germany, in Munich, and he's still there. He's still there in the Waldfriedhof Cemetery in Munich. His grave is there. So he's been accepted by the Germans in a way that he would never be accepted by the Soviets, or now the Russians, the same. There's a lot of interest according to his death. They thought that he was listed as a suicide, that he had taken cyanide himself and killed himself. But because he had a sudden seizure on this day, and he fell and broke his neck. So Munich police surmised that the cyanide had been self-administered, which was caused him to fall. But in 1961, the case was reopened by the confession of the man responsible for his death, who confessed that he had done it at the work under the working for the secret Russian secret police. Now, the story about him is that 2 years after his death in 1961, September 17th, the German judicial bodies announced German judiciary announced that Bandera's murderer had been a KGB defector, Bohdan Stashnitsky, who acted on the orders of Soviet KGB head Alexander Shelepin and Soviet Premier Nikita Khrushchev. After detailed investigation against Stashnitsky, a trial took place from 8 October to 15 October 1962. The sentence was handed down on the 19th of October, in which Stashnitsky was sentenced to 8 years imprisonment. The Federal Court of Justice in Germany confirmed at Karlsruhe that in the Bandera murder, the Soviet Secret Service was the main guilty party. Well, Bohdan Stashnitsky was threatened and was forced to commit this crime, this murder against Bandera. And that's why he got such a light sentence, because he went and turned himself in right afterwards. So here's something from the Kiev Post. First, I'll say that the Soviet Union had always actively campaigned to discredit Bandera and all other Ukrainian national partisans of World War II. That's one thing. And in an interview with Russian newspaper Pravda, In 2005, the former KGB chief Vladimir Kryushkov claimed that the murder of Stepan Bandera was one of the last cases when the KGB disposed of undesired people by means of violence. This was a former KGB chief who admitted that he was killed by the KGB, which or earlier was called the NKVD. Now, here's a story, though, that I came upon from the Kiev Post, October 2008, an editorial by someone named Yuri Lukanov, a Ukrainian, okay, to make that clear. And he writes, "The great Ukrainian nationalist," meaning Bandera, "got a bum rap from Soviet propagandists. He has been gone for nearly half a century, but people continue quarreling over him even more than over living political activists. The difference in approach is huge. Some people consider him a hero, while others claim he was a Nazi servant and traitor of Ukraine. Take, for example, the personality of Bandera's killer. Lviv student Bohdan Stashinsky," that he's the killer, okay, "agreed to cooperate." He was a student in Ukraine, in Lviv. "He agreed to cooperate with NKVD, the People's Commissariat of Internal Affairs," which was at that time, you know, was Russia, was in, under the control of the Russia. "He was a Soviet Union. He was given a terrible choice, either cooperate or his whole family, which had ties with the resistance movement led by Bandera, goes to Stalin's camps for 25 years. This was equal to a death sentence." Well, if true, you know, this shows how they get people to do things for him. You know, that's quite a threat. But after killing Bandera, Stashinsky surrendered to police in West Berlin. Do you think, though, that since NKVD was active, that if he surrendered to police and told the story, maybe he didn't tell the story? That's why they didn't know it. Maybe they kept that quiet, why they called it a suicide for a few years. Because then wouldn't the NKVD still do that to his family if they, I don't know. In the times of the Soviet Union, Stefan Bandera and his brothers-in-arms were scarecrows for the country's citizens. The Communist Party, which declared itself internationalist, was fiercely fighting against the so-called Ukrainian bourgeois nationalists. A Moscow that could not tolerate the very thought of Ukraine becoming an independent state painted all those who fought for it in the blackest colors. So Bandera became the symbol of Ukrainian bourgeois nationalism, which is a very, very bad thing to the communists. And I think it's interesting here that it says, and he says that at that time, Moscow could not tolerate the thought of Ukraine becoming an independent state. And it still can't tolerate the thought of Ukraine. Ukraine has become an independent state because of the fall of communism in 1991 and that whole scenario. So a lot of them became independent. But slowly, and under Vladimir Putin, the objective is to not allow these nations, even though Ukraine is independent, to not get so independent that it goes out from under the control, the influence, and, you know, really the control of what is now the Russian Federation. So it still can't tolerate the thought of Ukraine really being an independent entity. The article goes on to say, "He," meaning Bandera, "was the leader of the Organization of Ukrainian Nationalists, the OUN, which declared in the 1930s that its primary goal was fighting for Ukraine's independence." That's what he declared. That is it. It declared war against all governments that controlled ethnic Ukrainian lands or territories where ethnic Ukrainians had a majority. Now, that would include Germany, National Socialist Germany. That would include the Soviet Union. At the time, that would include anything called Poland, or, you know, that would include anybody that wasn't Ukraine, and that was their hardcore position, that there's only one thing they were fighting for, and that was an independent Ukraine, and nobody else should be there, and nobody else should have any control of any of it. First and foremost, it reads, the leaders of the communist USSR destroyed the Ukrainian intellectual elite through an artificial famine in 1932-33, when a minimum of 6 million people died, this article says. One of Bandera's achievements was the creation of the Ukrainian Insurgent Army, which carried out armed resistance in the forests and mountains of western Ukraine against both the USSR and Germany during World War II. After the war was over, the UPA continued to fight. Compared to other peoples, it was the Ukrainians who turned out to be the most persevering. While other nations, at least the Ukrainian nationalists, while other nations laid down their arms by the end of the 40s, the Ukrainian mass resistance movement lasted until the mid-50s. Individual fights continued way into the early 60s. But they can't say that this is all Ukrainians who were behind this. It wasn't. It was just this large enough group to matter, but, you know, these resistance fighting nationalists, it wasn't all Ukrainians who it kind of makes it sound this way here. It seemed that after Ukraine pronounced independence in 1991, all fighters for Ukraine statehood would get the recognition they deserved. For a long time, this subject remained relatively neutral. It did not cause particularly heated discussions. But after the changes in power of 2005, that's the Yushchenko-Yanukovych deal, a new ideological campaign started against President Viktor Yushchenko, who insists that all Ukrainians who fought on opposite sides of barricades, both UPA and the Soviet Red Army fighters in Ukraine, should shake hands and reconcile, like the Spanish did after their civil war. But Yushchenko's opponents started to exploit stereotypes that had been forced onto Ukrainians for decades. As part of the pro-Russian population's nostalgia for the Soviet Union, it was agreed that serving Hitler was the greatest of Bandera's faults. At the same time, they turned a blind eye toward the fact that Germany and the Soviet Union cooperated in the beginning with that Ribbentrop-Molotov Pact. OUN and Bandera haters continue perceiving the USSR as the medium of truth and all good that broke the neck of the beast of fascism. They again turn a blind eye to the fact that the communist regime of the USSR differed very little from the Nazi regime of Germany. It doesn't even occur to them that the relations with the Germans were tactical, while the strategic goal was achieving Ukraine's independence. They deny that OUN had its own interests and was fighting for them against the will of the states at war. That's right. And the National Socialist Wehrmacht understood that, and it was the rationale for what they did and didn't do. That's me saying that. The National Socialists and the Wehrmacht understood that the Ukraine nationalists had their own interests and were fighting for them against the will of the states that were at war, both Germany and the Soviet Union. And that was the rationale for what the National Socialists did and didn't do. Now, even Russia's ex-president, I'm still reading this article, but almost done with it. Even Russia's ex-president, Vladimir Putin, scolded the Ukrainian insurgent army. If this tiny army had never had more than 100,000 fighters at a time, that had never had more than 100,000 fighters at a time, continues to keep the leaders of a huge nuclear state awake at night, it means that it had a spiritual victory. And so did its leader and inspiration, Stepan Bandera. Well, you know, he has to have a good closing there for his article, but there's a lot in here which explains what was taking place and why things happened the way they did. You can be not against somebody, but if they're not working in your interest, they're working against your interest, you have to put them out of commission, and that's what the Germans did by arresting him and taking him to Germany and then keeping him at Sachsenhausen for a couple of years under protection. Now, a couple of items here to finish up. During the 2014 Crimean crisis and 2014 pro-Russian conflict in Ukraine, pro-Russian, that's this year, pro-Russian Ukrainians, Russians in Russia, and Russian President Vladimir Putin all alluded to the bad influence, in their opinion, of Bandera on Euromaidan protesters and pro-Ukrainian unity supporters in justifying their actions. As we know, and I don't have any more examples of that, but we know that Putin more and more started out doing it with Crimea with the whole Maidan, Euromaidan protests and the ousting of his chosen president of Ukraine. He has been blaming the nationalists, the Nazis, etc., and he includes Bandera and Stepan Bandera and all those Ukrainian, the whole history of Ukrainian nationalism, of which Bandera seems to be pretty much the poster boy and the example that is given and was used, his picture was used by a lot of protesters in those Ukrainian, early Ukrainian protests and so on. And in getting rid of the pro-Russian president. So it's the position of Russia and those who are supportive of Russia and certainly of the Russian President Putin that these are bad people and they are the enemy. The nationalists, anything to do with Nazism, anything to do with Hitler, and that is not going to change. That's solid there. And anybody who thinks that this is some kind of a tactic that's being used, that isn't real, I think they need to get real because this is not going to change. So these people are the enemies of National Socialists. They always have been, still are. And to me, the present Russian government is veering more and more toward the Soviet Union style and the communist attitudes, and I can't see the value of deluding oneself into thinking that they can be worked with because they are somehow traditionalist. They want a traditional world. They want traditional values, and they're against certain Western excesses that are going on today that have been brought about by Jewry. But Jewry is there are plenty of Jews getting rich in Russia. Nobody wants to talk about that. To say that Putin has been arresting Jewish oligarchs is to me just a joke because, you know, very selective in who he arrests, and the rest of them are all allowed to continue, and there's lots of them. Boy, it's just amazing how many Jewish billionaires there are in Russia, and then after that, millionaires, and it's all mostly connected with oil and gas. But that's quite a racket they've got going there. Well, it's interesting to watch it all. Let me just say, I have a little item here from Ceylon, which is a terrible left-wing site. But I just, this just came, I don't know where it came from. Somebody came from something that in my email. But it's interesting what they say here. They say, whatever his many other sins, even Vladimir Putin's harshest critics concede that he's not an anti-Semite. As the New Republic's Julia Jaffa notes, a number of his closest confidants, as well as the judo teacher who served as a mentor and surrogate father, are Jews. He has personally intervened in cases of state anti-Semitism, such as an incident last year in which a teacher was charged with corruption and the prosecution used his Jewish last name as evidence. Putin labeled that egregious, and the conviction was overturned soon after. Well, if Putin would enter into a judicial affair like this and give an opinion that he thought something was wrong, well, you can see that his power in Russia is such that that they are afraid to continue with it. They just overturned the whole conviction based on that. Not because of it was egregious, maybe, but just because Putin commented on it negatively. But this it's true that this judo teacher was actually, I believe it's that man who he says lived in that family that lived in the same building he did in St. Petersburg when he was a youngster. And he got to know this family and liked them, and the father of the family was taught him judo and so on. When they supposedly he was like a father to him, and they were a Jewish family. That's what's being referred to there. And you know, when you have a good relationship with a Jewish family when you're young like that, when you're a teenager, or you know, in those years when you're so vulnerable and easily influenced, you don't ever get over that. You always have a good feeling about those people then. And I think that's a situation that did happen to Putin. My mother growing up in Chicago, her best friend in high school was a Jewish girl, and there was she liked going to this girl's home. Said her family was real nice. She went there, you know, fairly often, and was liked them very much. And so she's never been able, even though she knows what the Jews do and she understands it. And my father was very anti-Jewish, but my mother always kind of kept a feeling that you know, probably they're not all bad or something, or you know, there's a lot of good to them, whatever, because she liked this family. And she didn't have the happiest adolescent life. And so her parents didn't, it was a terrible time. My mother grew up in a very bad time economically. And my grandmother had to work. And so lots of times, you know, she was, when my mother would come home from school, there would be nobody in the house. So she probably liked going over to her friend's house. I don't think they cared for Jews too much, but they weren't going to interfere because they were just happy she had a friend that she liked. And they were very good friends. Seemed like a nice girl. Evelyn was her name. Anyway, that will affect you. You know, I'm glad that didn't happen to me so that I have to be affected by that. Now, the last thing I'm going to say is to bring up Ludmila Bogantinkova, who I was been looking for information about her, and so I just found it today in these Kiev articles, these Kiev newspaper articles, and it turned. You know, I did a post on her a while back. She's the one that was a human rights worker for the mothers of the soldiers, mothers of looks after, helps mothers find out information about their sons who are in the military, and if they're and has done work for exposing kind of what do you call that, harassment that the older ones do to the new ones. It's called there's a name for it, you know, where they put them through all sorts of terrible things because they can, the ones who are just coming in to boot camp and so on. Anyway, she was arrested because they were looking into the soldiers who had been killed in Ukraine, and they wasn't being reported that they were killed in Ukraine, and they were exposing a lot of that. Well, next thing you knew, this woman was arrested, and they said they arrested her for fraud. She's 73 years old, and this was a few months ago, and she's still in jail. 73-year-old woman with certain kind of health problem. I don't know what it was, but and they brought now, it says the Kremlin has brought two charges against her. She's the president of the Mothers of Primkumia Human Rights Organization. Well, Primkumia is a certain area, which is down there close to Ukraine in Russia. The two charges they brought against her are for fraud and for failing to repay a debt. Both charges, the Moscow journalist says, are connected with her efforts to find out about Russian combat losses in Ukraine and to communicate this to others. The problem is, says the vice president of the Moscow Center for Political Technologies, that such charges give a patina of legality to what is a political campaign, and that they will harm this woman's reputation and keep her from doing her work, even if, as might happen, they are shown in court to be without any foundation. So, you know, they're just interfering. They're preventing her from doing what she's doing, and they might do harm to her reputation. Of course, she's old enough, but still, she still wants to do this work. Even if by the time she gets to court, and that could be several years, you know, there's no foundation of the charges. It's just harassment, and I find this kind of thing that the Russian government does pretty terrible. And this goes together with what I was saying earlier about how in the Finnish war they wanted to cover up the number of casualties that they were suffering. They always want to cover up everything. And whether they're the Soviet Union or whether they're the Russian Federation under Vladimir Putin, they behave the same. It's a country that, it's a people and a government that controls everything and lies to the people and doesn't tell them the truth so that they don't have to be open about what they're doing. And they just get forced their citizens into a war that they don't want to be in. They really wouldn't want to. They really don't want to go to war with Ukraine. They don't want to do it, but they're not told about it. They're told lies, and then they're told lies about Ukraine, etc. So they're everybody's in the dark, and this is how they do things. So, ladies and gentlemen, that's about it. And look, I did use up the 2 hours after all. So, but I'm going to say good night for now. So I'm going to say goodnight now for the Heretics Hour on December 1st, 2014. Please join me again and join me and Ray Goodman on Thursday for Back to Table Talk, Hitler's Table Talk, another episode of that. So we'll see you. I'll see you on Thursday. Good night for now.